The Mohawk, or Ganyatkahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatkahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR, reviving Ganasadage Radio.
Hi, Brother Clifford Dalfit. I donate $100 to support my favorite radio shows for the annual funding drive. I encourage all the listeners, promoter, community members to donate. CKUT forever and CKUT till infinity.
Infinity.
Perfect. Ha, thank God.
What's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. We have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial. Yes, 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 we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and on the air with us, a guest that I've known for quite some time is a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and facilitator in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Originally from Trinidad and Tobago, her purpose and passion is the mental and emotional well-being and liberation of black people, with an emphasis on black immigration, immigrants, and first-generation folks. Whether it is holding space for others, encouraging and training others to step into their leadership, or shifting culture through strategic planning and facilitation, she's known for always coming back to the importance of grounding the work in this purpose. Gabrielle Jackson is the owner and chief of wellness and care at Diasporic Healing LLC, committing to holding space and increasing access, equity, and understanding of mental health and well-being among members of the community at all levels. Until September 2021, Gabrielle was the co-executive director of the UndocuBlack Network, a multi-generational network and of currently and formerly undocumented Black immigrant people committing to advocacy and policymaking, narrative building and shifting, and centering community through wellness and organizing. When Gabrielle has free time, she's spending time with her family, reading books, enjoying sunshine, and collaborating with her three-year-old on how to find the North Star. Gabrielle Jackson, welcome to Soul Perspectives up here in Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
Thank you so much for that beautiful welcome. It is a pleasure and an honor to be with you today, sharing space today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. It's a pleasure to have voices from across North America and beyond, you know, originally from Trinidad and Tobago.
Hey.
We always want to make sure that we get as many people from to have as many different perspectives as possible. So we've kind of had a really hectic 2 years. The past 2 years, we're kind of at that right now. We're in March, and it's at that anniversary time of 2020 when all of this first really, really hit hard, and we had to go into lockdown and start wearing masks and everything. And I was just wondering, you know, you are a social worker, therapist, and facilitator. How has this impacted you just as a human being and, of course, professionally as well?
Yeah, I mean, the last 2 years, they have been, I think the word intense is the first word that comes to mind for me. I remember 2 years ago in March, actually, I was actually in the process of having a medical procedure when everything was getting shut down. Wow. So it started with this intensity of like, and here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, it was like, all right, y'all, we're shutting down for a couple of weeks. I don't know what it was like in other places, but for the most part, they were promising 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so it went from 2 weeks to extending it to a few months. And now we're over the last 2 years, really like shifting the way of life, the way we are seeing ourselves, the way we function, the way we work, the way we interact with people. And so like on a personal level, it definitely has changed and added perspective for me. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the people that I end up working with, like this was something that we could not have anticipated, even mm-hmm. with a little bit of information. And there's been so much changes, not just the actual physical laws of the reality of losing people
mm-hmm.
Through death and other losses, but the idea of like the loss we experience ambiguously, meaning like loss of relationships looking the way it was, mm-hmm. loss of like what jobs and job expectations have been, you know, through the midst of us trying to function and perform through a pandemic. There's a lot that has shown up for different people that I've noticed. And it's just like anybody else as a social worker and therapist, same way.
Mm-hmm.
And what it meant was a lot of me making changes within myself as well in terms of expectations of self or what we might have of others. So I would say the last 2 years have really been intense and an opportunity for transformation in different ways that we did not expect.
Yes. And what are some ways that you've experienced transformation?
Yeah. So one, everything, quote unquote, went virtual.
Right.
So at the start of the pandemic, I personally had already been working from home and having a team. I was working with a team that was across the United States. So technically we were virtual. We had a site where we where's our quote-unquote headquarters
right.
in Washington, D.C. But for the most part, we were working. So, you know, it was virtual as is. That didn't mean we were prepared
no.
for what it would mean to be virtual on a long-term basis or to really support
yeah.
a team mm-hmm. on a virtual setting. You know, so it meant me reviewing a bunch of the policies, reviewing a bunch of the practices, a lot of the organizational stuff, and seeing like what really was working and what's not, talking to the staff, talking to the team, really engaging in organizing skills, even within a team setting, mm-hmm. to really get what people were in need of, what they wanted, what was supportive, what was not, and shifting what virtual work looked like, shifting what virtual, you know, relationships looked like on a employment level. Outside of the virtualness of just the work setting,
mm-hmm.
the work setting on a team level, I actually would have been practicing private practice, having not shared a physical space with clients right. over the last 2 years.
Right.
And so it is actually a lot. That was one of the things is telehealth has existed for years. It's yes. decades.
Yeah.
It has existed for decades.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, many people in the field were scared about practicing and they didn't know how it would be to be able to practice not physically in the same room with somebody. Mm-hmm. And so when the pandemic hit, it was like, you know, in order to increase access, in order to ensure people's safety yeah. to practice, we could do this. And so over the last few years, I've been practicing and engaging and holding space with people online, face-to-face, using a computer screen.
Yeah.
So things like that, you know, things like that on a, like a structural level, those are some of the things that have changed outside of just, you know, emotionally and psychologically, a lot of different things, a lot mm-hmm. of different things have been showing up for us. Mm-hmm.
And your child is now 3.
Yes.
So she was around 1 at the beginning of the pandemic. So how was that, having a child not necessarily being able to be as free with movement outside as you mm-hmm. used to be, maybe being a lot more paranoid about that, I can imagine as well.
Yeah. Just to be transparent, so I had my child in 2018. Mm-hmm. This was way before the pandemic, you know, really hit. Mm-hmm. And in my postpartum, you know, now postpartum is actually extended beyond just, you know, the first year. But for the most part, that postpartum time frame, I actually had really heightened anxiety about would I be able to care for her. I was really heightened in my anxiety and my concern about, can I care for her? Can I protect her? Mm-hmm. Particularly around like colds and flus, like that really actually was my thing. You know, what if we went outside and somebody, because of, you know, the heightenedness of people like reaching out and touching children and, or trying to hug and kiss and not really having boundaries. So it was funny, you know, that the fact is my anxiety in general from the beginning was me learning how to navigate, you know, that in her first year and getting like her first cold and me feeling like, okay, I'm good. So when the pandemic hit, we were actually had just been in the process of actually going out more often. We were doing story time. Mm. So we would go to the library and for those who have not been in story time, there are a number of children within an age range that would go to the library and they sit around and these children are from different households, different places, and they all play with toys and put things in their mouth and lick things. And so like that was me integrating myself and being like kids doing kids.
Gotta be kids.
And so me and my baby having the time of our life, running around the library, you know, doing story time, having a structure, having a routine around that actually allowed me also to feel like I was connecting with her and giving her time and space because I'm also working.
Right.
And even though I was working from home, there was this assumption that working from home means there's more time. It does not. And so it was me dedicating this time to her to have this Wednesday morning for us to go to story time, enjoy ourselves, run around the library, pick up books, practice checking out, and then go on for a short drive afterwards. Mm-hmm. So then the pandemic hit. And I think that was one of the losses I experienced was the idea of loss of time that I could have dedicated one-to-one to her.
Right.
And having this activity that I felt really connected to as somebody who, even in my younger years, really connected to being at the library. Mm-hmm. And so I experienced one of the losses of like going from that to now being inside all the time and having a child that is younger who is not in school yet and then making a decision. Do I want to put her in any programs as they start to open back up? And ultimately, over the last 2 years, what has happened is that we have stayed pretty much within our pod, like our pod really being in our household, which mm-hmm. is, my baby is very social.
Right.
Very, for having not engaged with a number of people her age, she's very social, very animated, very adventurous. She's the type of baby that will climb on top of something very high and fly off of it, like, and very adventurous, very, like,
the ones that basically give you heart attacks 24/7.
And it making sure that your cardio is up. Myself, about fear, about taking a leap physically and figuratively, right?
Yeah.
So not being able to be around other children is what my major concern was and continues to be, you know, the main thing of like, you know, what, how do I make sure that my baby is having the opportunity to engage with other children her age? That has been the biggest change, you know, since from 1 to 3, vocabulary has skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. Conversations regularly, having, you know, personally as a parent wondering, still questioning, am I doing the right thing? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Am I being the best parent? You know, if my baby's not meeting certain milestones like potty training immediately or sleeping a certain way, all these other milestones are not discounted, but am I doing the best thing for her? Am I doing right? Should I be shifting how my strategies are? And so that's actually like heightened even more when everything's a little more isolated. Like, right, you don't really get to have the opportunity of, well, you can virtually get together with other people to talk about it.
It's not the same,
idea of sharing space with somebody.
It's not the same, though. It's not the same.
Yeah, not the same. So I think seeing her and seeing her has been amazing in these last few years. Mm-hmm. Seeing myself, I am working on making sure that I practice some of the same things, affirmations for myself. Like, you know, you're doing a good job. Like, whole pandemic, you're doing a good job. Like, yeah. So that's actually like something really big that actually has been sitting with me over the last couple of years.
It's been challenging for everyone, and it's like you have to just take it in stride almost. You don't have a choice. I mean, everybody's experiencing this together. This is new for everyone universally. I've been fortunate enough to interview a lot of people from a wide range of different backgrounds and disciplines, and like it goes from the person who got completely shut off and shut down and just had to go into the little cocoon to the person who blossomed like a flower as the pandemic started. They're like, oh, what? I don't have to go out and meet anybody? That's amazing. Great. You know, I don't have to deal with my anxiety of like touching people and looking at people. Fine. Perfect. You know, so there's this whole range of it's like you said, you're doing your best. You do the best that you can, and nobody can reprimand you for that. I think that we all put too much stress on each other. We have enough stress as it is, and we're going to get into that soon. But we as individual human beings, we have enough stress as it is, and then we just add more stress because, you know, we're trying to live up to this person's expectations, or we're trying to meet certain criteria that someone says, that, you know, some book says that by this time you should be this. And it's like, I often look back at my life and I'm like, my parents had me when they were 22 and 26 years old.
Yeah.
And I look back at when I was 22 years old and I'm like, there is no way in hell that I would allow that 22-year-old or even that 26-year-old to take care of a child. Like, no, it's not happening. You would literally kill the child. Like,
I thought, you know, in my head, I had this thing in my head that I was having a child years ago, having a child by the time I was 26. I don't know where I got that idea. I think it was because my mom had me when she was 26, 28, like when she had me and my sister. Mm-hmm. But this idea of like, look, a lot of
and then
that
when you reached that age, you were like, have a child? What? Make another human being? Be
so
responsible?
Even prior, like, just the expectations are just, like, that's actually a big thing for me, expectations and shifting understanding of what we know just because of tradition versus the idea of, like, possibility. We are societally placed into certain things based on understanding of what society is saying, based on what we expect other people are saying. And so even myself had to go through that own shift when I was starting therapy after having a child, like, postpartum, right. I went into therapy, and it was a lot the idea of like comparing myself to other people and seeing other parents or seeing them. That was even my experience, even in therapy. That is actually a really big thing for me in how I personally have my own shift, but also like how I work together with people.
Mm-hmm. And I think about it, and I'm like, even now, my child was also born in 2018, and. Mm-hmm. And I think about it and I'm like, there's so much there's so much that I think about. I'm like, when he's 20, I'm going to be 60-something. Am I going to be able to be, like... in my head, I'm like, I'm going to encourage my kid to have children early because I want to be a grandfather. And yes. I want to still be... there's so much going on in my mind. But we forget that as social human beings, we evolve. And we evolve socially. We're not just the same people that we were, that our parents were. Because we're talking about two completely different generations. We're the generation that was born at the end of the 20th century. And, you know, most of us are called born in the late 1900s, which... I'm like, you millennial, I want to flick my pen at these millennials. But they're not lying. They're not lying. So we just got to, as my father would have said, just sit down and swallow. Gulp it down, because it's the truth. But we are in this kind of cross-generational thing. We were there at the beginning of the internet with the the dial-up and all of that. Like, these young cats don't even know. They don't know. And now we're in this high, quote-unquote, high technological phase, where we're mature in this technological phase, where we can do things like this. And this is new to us for the most part, but to our children, it'll be a second nature. It'll be just like, yeah, whatever, you know? What? People never used to communicate through their computers and their cameras? What?
How did you communicate?
They'd have to turn a thing on a phone. I'd love to have a rotary dial phone at my house. A functioning rotary dial. I would love to have one.
Oh, so just that to
when
show
my,
you.
When my kid comes and he's like a teenager and he's like, Dad, what's that? I'm like, that's the phone that we have. No cell phones for a day. Yeah. But all that to say that we've evolved, and so having children at a certain age is not necessarily something that everyone wants to do or everyone feels that they're ready to do. And in certain cultures, they say that you're not an adult until you reach your 30s. You know, so... And I think about it, and when I was in my 20s, I was pretty damn stupid and immature and, like, not fully developed up here, like, in my brains. So,
which is a reality.
Yeah.
Up here, that frontal part of it's actually, research has shown over time, and I wish I could remember the study, but actually not developed until the late 20s, early 30s.
There you go.
So, like, us being 20-something, trying to be adults. Like,
right? When you talk about, oh, can't wait to be... No, you probably shouldn't be allowed to drink until you're 31. In your 20s, like, we make these... We're not... Like, I look back at my 20s and I'm like, okay, I did a lot of good things, but damn, I could have done without doing some of the stupidness that I did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's... the expectations have to evolve as well.
Right.
And the things that we do... have to evolve as well, because we can't keep doing the same thing over and over. It's the definition of madness, right? And like now, you know, the new 60s, the new 40, people who are 60 years old are looking like, you know, athletes and looking real good. And I think back to like people who looked 60 in the 1980s and 90s. They looked 60. They look like 60. You know, they're looking like they're on a decline. But now people who look 60 are looking like, okay, they may have be fully gray or whatever, but people are taking better care of themselves. People are, you know, looking to have healthier lives and stuff like that. So there's a whole evolution that's happening that we got to respect. And if most of us are feeling like, you know what, we need to have kids at a later age, then that's fine. I still think that it's good to have kids at an earlier age because, I don't know, I think about it. I'm 42 this year and my kid's going to be 4. And there's a part of my brain that's like, I'm going to be real old when he's like just coming up. You know? And there's a part of me that's like, oh, and then mortality comes into it as well. Yeah. You know, it's like... Is this, should I have done this earlier? Should I have made these decisions? Shoulda, coulda, woulda, never baked bread.
It's a lot of shoulds, yeah?
Yeah, but there's a lot to think about. But as I say, evolution is important, and we have to kind of respect that we're an continuously evolving species. Yeah. On that note, if you are just joining us this evening, we are speaking to Gabrielle Jackson all the way from Washington, D.C. She is a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and facilitator. We do have to take a quick break. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Till I'm laid to rest, yes, always be depressed. There's no life in the waste. I know the East is the best. All the propaganda then spread, tongues will have to confess. Oh, I'm in bondage, living is a mess. And I've got to rise up, alleviate the stress. No longer will I expose my weakness. Ego signal it begins with humbleness. Work 7 to 7, yet me still penniless. For the food up on me table, master, God bless. All of it the needy and shelterless. Ethiopia await all prince and princess. Till I'm laid to rest, yes, always be depressed. There's no life in the West. I know the East is the best, yes. Propaganda then spread, tongues will have to confess. What could a man say about the East? Everybody want a peace. Africa free, Africans, man. I speak unification, no number defeat. What a day when we walk in down Redemption Street. Man up on head, Bible in a hand, one and all. Make we try the promised land. Would you go down the Congo, stop in the Shashama on the land? The city of Ferraris, where Selassie come from? In Addis Ababa, then Botswana. Left Kenya, I end up in a Ghana. The beauty my eyesight behold. Holy Ethiopia, protect me from the cold. Till I'm laid to rest, yes, always be depressed. There's no life in the West. I know the East is the best. All the propaganda can spread, tongues will have to confess. Organize and centralize, come as one. Overseas shall be so many more than sand. Some new one.
Yes, 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 it's that time of year again. CKUT's annual funding drive. The theme for this year is CKUT Till Infinity. CKUT is a community-based university radio station, and this year's goal is $35,000. Here at Soul Perspectives, we would like our listeners and supporters to help us reach our personal goal of 10% of that, $3,500. We need just 100 people to donate $35 each. There will be prizes and surprises for all of our supporters. You can mail your checks to 3647 University Street or go to ckut.ca/donate. The fundraising drive officially runs from March 17 to 27. Please specify Soul Perspectives on your donation contribution. You can also donate at any point in time in the year. You are listening to Soul Perspectives on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Yeah. one-stop Caribbean cuisine for the best in Caribbean dishes. Come visit us and enjoy our specialties such as oxtail, jerk chicken, roti, and many more. Ask about our $8 lunch special on any chicken plates from Tuesdays to Fridays, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Also try our famous crispy fried chicken dipped in our special barbecue sauce. You can order online through your preferred restaurant apps or call 514-365-3636 or enjoy a 10% discount on all in-store pickup. This don't apply to promotions. We are located at 334 Saint Jacques in Lachine. Visit us today. One Stop Caribbean Cuisine, Chef X, new location. Blessing up the flow
like a river. Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and I'm speaking to Gabrielle Jackson, who is the owner and chief of wellness and care at Diasporic Healing LLC, committing to holding space and increasing access, equity, and understanding of mental health and well-being among members of the community at all levels. And she is based in Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Gabrielle, thank you so much once again for being here. So, licensed clinical social worker, therapist, facilitator. Take us through, like, what made you decide to go into social work, clinical social work, therapy, and facilitation? How did you get there?
Yeah. So growing up, I actually believed that I actually was going to go into medicine. I think, like a lot of us, like, we hear a lot about
one of the big threes.
One of the big threes,
law,
right?
Medicine, or accounting.
Right, exactly. Those three things. And so I actually believed for a very long time that I was going into medicine. And I actually associated it a lot with the idea of, like, taking care of others, being able to care for others. Mm-hmm. And by eighth grade, knew, oh, yeah, I'm going into medicine. Like, had watched this, like, special expose on TV and was, like, about inequities that occurred in among communities that were, like, more impoverished, more socioeconomic level was lower. Mm-hmm. And I remember just in eighth grade knowing that I was going into medicine. And then as I walked through college and I went through my undergrad experience, had the opportunity to engage with a person who eventually became my mentor. Mm-hmm. And Claire became my mentor and was a public health professional. And we were in this class called stress management. Mm. Like, okay. We were teaching others and facilitating conversations to others, mainly in the college setting, around managing our stress.
Right.
And I remember her talking to me and saying, I don't think you really want to go into medicine. The way you describe yourself, the way you function, like, you know, I think you might consider public health, actually. You might really want to consider public health.
Okay, what's the difference?
And so public health, medicine, being able to practice medicine in terms of, like, go in and there's a diagnosis and you treat the diagnosis. Whereas right. public health had a more holistic look and view of, like, okay, what are the contexts? What are the issues associated with what's going on? Where the inequities lie? Is it actually, and this is how it actually came for me for social work. It actually was a combination for me. Are there gaps and are there resources? Where are the resources take place? How do we look at this less as a treatment and more as preventative?
Okay.
Preventative. Putting things into preventative places, addressing the actual issues as they are on a broader level, as opposed to, like, individualized, like, this is the diagnosis, this is the treatment. And okay. So not to downplay anybody playing engaged in medicine, but it's the idea of, like, there are different philosophies associated.
Right. So is it like you're looking not only at the individual, but you're looking at all of the extenuating factors that could mm-hmm. be in, that could affect that person on
right
when it comes to
and increase
health.
The likelihood of their health changing a certain way, because there are many different factors. So what are the factors that need to be addressed? So the mm-hmm. idea of, like, looking at it not just as, okay, now we know there's an issue, let's treat this issue. Mm-hmm. It's across the continuum of, like, okay, what are the things that led to the issue in the first place? Okay, right. Now that we know about the issue, what do we do about this issue, and what are some resources that might be in place? And the fact of the matter is, many medical professionals actually also attach public health as part of their, how they develop their philosophy. So you may see here in the United States, either an MD, a DO, many, like, the medical degrees, and they'll okay. have /MPH. They'll have a master's in public health or something.
Okay.
So the idea of, like, addressing not just what's in front of you, but across a spectrum.
Right.
Like, what's happening.
Okay.
And so what happened was, a few years later, it going through the, like, you know, like the disappointment of, like, you know, I'm not going to medical school. Like, okay. And realizing for myself in my 20s that I'm not going to medical school. And I actually, going back to expectations, felt like I was letting down my family by not going to medical school. For my whole entire life, it was always Dr. Gabby, Dr. Gabby, Dr. Gabby.
Yeah.
And this idea of, like, Dr. Gabby will be the one to take care of the family. And this, and it's, it was out of love when people said it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I actually had a conversation with my mother at some point, I kept thinking I was disappointed, particularly my grandparents. Mm. So when it comes to migration, and we think about migration, a lot of the things that, like, the underlying things around is, like, the idea of better opportunity and taking advantage to be in a more elevated place, having access to education. And so when I thought a lot about medicine, I thought maybe I'm disappointing in particular my grandparents.
Right.
And so, yes, there's this running joke about how immigrant parents, when you move to foreign, you're like, the ones to be like hard-lined on, like, education and what you have to do and what you have to be.
Yeah.
And that happens. And when having this conversation with my mother, she's like, we're proud of you regardless. Mm. She's like, you know, it's like, it's just like, you know, like, you don't have to worry about, like, your grandparents are proud of you regardless of what you do. Yes, they might say certain things, but it's either because you told them that you wanted something. So they were encouraging you in a certain thing. But whatever you do, they will encourage you. Same thing with me. Whatever you do, whatever you choose, we will encourage you. So having that, and then I had what happened was, to be honest, a friend said, girl, I'm signing up, I'm registering and applying for this social work program. Come on, do it with me.
Right.
And I was like,
wait, what?
I was like, okay. She's like, come on, let's apply together. And I was like, okay. But then when I read through actually what social work and what the possibility of social work and where I was going to Howard University, where they had a particular perspective about the diaspora. They called it the Black perspective, but about, like, the impact of having, you know, the opportunity of engaging in social work as a black person who had a perspective from the diaspora. Yeah. I was like, yeah, this is it. Mm-hmm. So the idea of, like, I had one shifting again, like, with the idea of meaning to support others meant and learning that about myself and going into social work. And what I ended up studying was a lot of, like, focused on displaced populations, people who were displaced, whether for multiple reasons, mine being having a personal experience, having gone through migration to the United States. And I actually focused a lot on, while I understood clinical aspects and I learned about clinical aspects, I actually focused a lot on the macro. A lot around the community organizing, around the program design and development, a lot around the policy and understanding, like, how those are actually developed. So having this idea of, like, the macro and the clinical was actually really important to me, to be able to practice like that, recognize that there's a clinical direct care and how that's an impact we can have on individual and family and group levels. And the things that you practice on that ground level also can create changes on the broader spectrum, the systems level as well. That's how I ended up coming to this space. So turning points was, you know, some disappointment about myself.
Right.
My mother giving me a good, like, you know, we still love you regardless. We love you.
Right.
And a friend saying to me, come on, apply for this thing for me. Like, let's apply to this thing together.
Yeah.
Let's go to social work school together.
Yeah. I'm so curious, like, how much did stereotypes play into your fear and your disappointment? Because, I mean, I'm half Jamaican, half Haitian, and there are so many, like, you can go, just look at Haitian sketches and Jamaican sketches, and you'll find all of these sketches about, you know, coming home at night late and you know, having girlfriend and boyfriend and what you're doing in school and all of that. And personally, I didn't experience half of those things, but I know about them as stereotypes. So, and I look at my family and I'm like, I didn't have a conventional family. And the people that I know around me didn't have conventional families. So, like, at what point do the stereotypes actually play with your mind in, like, making that disappointment? Like, how much did the stereotypes that we see on a regular basis when it comes to consuming our own Caribbean media, how much of that is actually forming forming in our head that, oh, I need to actually, I'm disappointing because I'm not doing what my parents told me that they wanted from me. But like in your case, it was you that told your parents, you know, so how much of the stereotype is affected you when it came to that?
Yeah. What we if have it, to acknowledge. Pardon?
If at all.
Yeah. What we have to acknowledge is that there is a greater, it comes down to societal understandings and things that are ingrained or even pushed, like including oppressively, like pushed on what standards or expectations should be placed on people.
Right.
So, you know, within the United States, there's a context that, and most places in general, when we look at immigrants, the idea is that what they are supposed to do and how they're supposed to perform.
Right.
And they're supposed to act a certain way, be a certain way, and they're supposed to add. And add the idea society. Of right. And so the idea is that idea around, and it's very oppressive. It's based on standards of whiteness about the idea of performance and labor.
Mm-hmm.
That is exported across the world.
Right.
Right. And so we received it in the Caribbean as well. It's the idea of like when you migrate, when you go, it's for a better education. You have to go there. You have to do well. Do not fail. Mm-hmm. Do not fail. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The idea is like, what does failure actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens is what we do is we receive these messages and we then start to incorporate them and internalize them ourselves.
Right. That's what I was going
to
say.
We internalize them ourselves about like when you go, like the idea of failure means you coming back to the country of origin. How is that a failure?
Right.
The idea of failure is you didn't get this particular type of position, but you're still employed. How is that a failure?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact is like a lot of the stereotypes are actually like it's things that we may have learned and ingrained in ourselves as a result culturally, like learning those things, but recognizing how oppression and white supremacy can play a role in that. And ultimately does play the role in that, in what we learn about what is expectations and labor. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of like moving to the United States and not becoming this doctor, whereas you can still have the idea of a cross success being whatever you define it to be, whether or not you own a business, it doesn't have to be a certain degree, but for the most part, the idea is that we received is that in order to perform, you need to be doing specific things, because if not, again, recognizing the context within the context of the United States of related to people who are of African descent here from slavery and on down, the idea is that then you'll be lazy and you'll be just like the folks who were indigenously here of African peoples, the people who were brought from the slave trade. And so African Americans have been constantly under this, the political and the place of constantly being told that they're not good enough.
Right.
And that they will never perform. They will never have. They'll never be good enough ever.
Yeah, you have to work twice as hard to get half.
Right, twice as hard to get right. So if all these laws and policies in place to ensure that they will never be good enough, and then be told constantly that they'll never be good enough. Now, mind you, you come from a place of foreign, and you come and you migrate, and that's the comparison that's happening for you. The comparison is if you do not perform, you'll be just like them.
Hmm.
If you do not perform and you don't succeed, you'll be just like them. And the fact of the matter, all of it is white supremacy playing across all of us as people.
Right.
As people of the diaspora, people of the African diaspora, people of color in general, it's the idea of that, those lessons being ingrained. And so it creates a level of like the division that comes up, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, those stereotypes and those fears, recognize the context of like what we're taught is that you cannot be lazy, you cannot fail, you cannot be. So the idea of just not being able to do that, that's where a lot of those come from. Yes, there was some concern about my parents and grandparents, but ultimately there's a broader context. The broader context is systemically, this is what things look like.
Right.
And so the idea of not, of failing, of not succeeding and not becoming a doctor really hit me hard, because then what am I?
Right.
Did I do a good job? Am I good enough? Mm. A lot of that came up. And this is in my early 20s, when a lot of us are trying to, like, in the early 20s, trying to figure out about ourselves, teenage years, 20s.
Yeah.
We're still really, we just talked about adulthood not really being formulated until like you're in your 30s, right?
Right.
So those stereotypes did play a role. And the stereotypes are not just based on just because, oh, they didn't just exist just because they exist. They actually were created and handcrafted for us.
Right.
So those stereotypes did play a role into that fear of like, am I gonna succeed? Am I gonna be able to take care of my family? Will my family care that, you know, I didn't go to medical school? I really think that they'll care about this, because then that impacts my ability to care for them and anybody else. Mm. It impacts my ability to be seen as a success, mm-hmm. to be seen that I came all the way to this country and you're not successful, you have failed.
Right. Because your definition of success became this idea that was highly influenced by white supremacy and the negativity associated with whiteness and the relationship to blackness in a North American context. And then, like, if I'm not mistaken, like, the children of immigrants are also their hope. So the immigrants, yes, work like the hardest jobs, whatever jobs they can find. A lot of the times, even now, we hear about, you know, immigrants coming to Canada, folks coming from the Middle East, folks coming from Haiti. They were all doctors and lawyers, and they had very high positions, but then they move up to Canada and they're taking whatever jobs they can get, everything from taxi drivers to janitors and all of that stuff, because their degrees don't translate. So they're like, mm-hmm. they're like working really hard at the quote unquote bottom level in order for their children to have better. And so you're kind of like the hope of, yeah, you're that shining hope. And then it's like, yeah, what does that shining hope look like if it doesn't fit into the big three, right? You know, the doctor, the lawyer, or the accountant, you know?
But what you offered was that your family and most families are not this standard, like, it's not the stereotype.
That's what I'm wondering, if it's actually like the because of the fact that we continuously have these comedy sketches about the stereotypes of our families, mm-hmm. Are those comedy sketches not in some way being detrimental to us? Because I can't, like, I laugh at those comedy sketches, mm-hmm. and to an extent I believe that they're true, mm-hmm. but if I was to look at the nucleus of my family and the nucleus of my friends, I can't say that it's true to us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, while we do have to take the fact that what white supremacy is there, systemic racism is there, and that's all affecting us, how much of what we're doing to ourselves is also like us continuing the work of the white supremacy and perpetuating it in an even worse way in order, mm-hmm. to entertain ourselves.
Right. It's perpetuating some of the things that, you know, if the thing is when we see these sketches or when we see media in that way, there's some reality for somebody in it.
Yeah.
There's some reality in there for it. So like whether it's comedic or whether it's tragic, like there is a reality and we feel it and it's empathetic towards what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And again, it is, We have to look at it. And the thing is, it's like sometimes things are just entertainment, yes. But look at it as usually as a broader context. And are we perpetuating some of the same ideas and some of the same expectations that white supremacy or like systemically when it comes to racism, any kind of the isms and any of the phobias, are we perpetuating some of the same things when we're, mm-hmm. engaging in that kind of entertainment?
Yeah.
And to be honest, is that it's both and. Like, we have to also look at things as the possibility of, like, it isn't always either or. Black and white is a very, very strict way of looking at things. Yeah. And our lives are not black and white.
No.
What we end up getting, though, is the idea that it has to be either or.
Yes.
Both, yes. And. Yes. And so what do we do then? Okay, if it's both and, what do we do to shift this idea of, like, not perpetuating the things, like, not perpetuating ideas and philosophies that are not in alignment with us, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and who we are as people, mm-hmm. while we recognize that those things exist at the same time. How do we do that? And so it's the opportunity for us to be able to really look at things as that there are broader contexts and that those things, those stereotypes don't typically fit any of us like hardline, like, yeah. ever, yeah. never does.
There's always a little bit, you know, like, okay, yes, I remember when I was younger and I did get a ass whooping, for example.
Right.
You know, that's
right.
Usually a typical one. But I put that spanking into context. Like, I was being super rude, or, mm-hmm. I lied about something and
that was kind of the last straw for my parents. It wasn't a situation of like, this was habitual, this was like a regular thing. I didn't have my mother pitching slippers at me because I copped an attitude with her, you know, like she would talk to me first, and then if it continued, then there was an escalation. And then if it continued, there were consequences before we get to that level of, you know, going and catching up something and running me down. But it wasn't the automatic thing that we always see in the sketches. You know, so it's really something that I've been questioning of late, is how much of it is true universally, like, and how much of it has to do with socioeconomic situations. So like poor education, I think that maybe people who have poor education will probably resort to more physical violence when it comes to disciplining their kids faster than someone who has a higher level of education and who's more open to conversation. You know, like there's so many different metrics with which to look at, that the standard that is set for us may not necessarily be the actual standard for everyone, because we are vast. Our community is vast. It's vast and it's small at the same time, because we easily connect one to the other. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, we are speaking to Gabrielle Jackson, who is a licensed clinical social worker therapist facilitator based in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. We talking about a lot of stuff, y'all. We're talking about a lot of stuff. If you're just tuning in, you're going to have to tune in at 8:31 and get the archives. But we do have to take a quick break, because we gotta play some music and pay some bills. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Je veux comprendre ce qui se passe. Je veux aimer sans impasse. Et les nouvelles défis, et le vent se faufile, et les démons après. Et enseigne la haine. Sommes-nous là, là-dehors? Sommes-nous là? Sommes-nous prêts? Sommes-nous là? Nous devons lutter. Solidarité, solidarité. Me libérer des menteurs qui mentent aux moutons, et le lion qui tente de le vaincre avec un savoir inné. On ne dort plus car brûle le monde entier. Sommes-nous là, là-dehors? Sommes-nous là? Sommes-nous prêts? Sommes-nous là? Nous devons lutter. Solidarité, solidarité.
Part de moi et remet au combat tous ces démons qui m'habitent. À quoi ça sert de pleurer le passé? Le tempo me libère des pressions démesurées. Je veux vivre moi, fiche-moi la paix et toi. Je suis née.
fait souvent, hanté par les tourments. Tous nos amours qui donnent et résonnent, mais ça ne vaut pas la peine de nourrir des rengaines. Jour et nuit, pourquoi
faut qu'il se déchire? By any means necessary, watching bands they talk, cause it's necessary. When we first got together, I just wanted to talk. All I want from you is licking money out of raw. Your lies will beat me to the floor.
Violence.
It ain't your fist, it's your words.
Silence.
All in all, don't worry about me. Call and call won't blurry what I see. Camouflage, I see all that you can be. If you drop that bloody bread and fall on your knees, cause bam, by any means necessary. Bam. By any means necessary, bam. By any means necessary. Watching bands stack tall, cause it's necessary, bam. By any means necessary, bam. By any means did you get that pay? By any means necessary. Watching bands stack tall, cause it's necessary. Every day, every night, let you make me cry. Never understood like I was the reason, so I creep in like in that TLC. Say I ain't but shit, friends got my heart, they leave you sick, you sick. All in all, don't worry about me. Pops fall and fall, but won't flurry my green. Revenge best served, I want my heart back. Avenge more like it, call it a heart attack.
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and my guest this evening is the owner of Chief of Wellness and Care at Diasporic Healing LLC, committing to holding space and increasing access, equity, and understanding of mental health and well-being among members of the community at all levels. Gabrielle Jackson, thank you so much for being here. I'm feeling real full with the conversation that we've had, and I think I'm about to feel stuffed with the conversation that we're gonna be continuing. So you've done a lot of work. You've done a lot of work basically when it comes to like changing, shifting your focus. So At first you wanted to be, when you were younger, you wanted to be in medicine. You wanted to become, as you said, it was all about Dr. Gabby when you were in your younger years. And then you shifted to public health. But you also did a lot because you've worked, you were the co-executive director of the UndocU Black Network. And So you've also done work when it comes to immigrants that are undocumented in the United States. You also do work when it comes to, mental health
yes.
as well. How do you do all of that?
So actually, from medicine, I shifted to social work. And so Public health is like the intermediary of like, but it's the idea of, I shifted to all of that because social work is actually for me, I found what I felt to be my home around practice about how I see things. So like people are within their environment. So what you mentioned in particular is that the two highest commitments I've always had is always a commitment to mental health and wellness.
Okay.
People's well-being.
Right.
And it showed up and found itself really grounding itself when I went to social work school. I went to Howard, and there was this opportunity for me to be able to focus on displaced populations. As someone who has the personal experience of having been an immigrant to the United States, having been an undocumented immigrant, having been an undocumented Black immigrant.
Right.
So I had the opportunity, thankfully, to find myself in my grounding about what was important for me. So it was me incorporating these skills and taking it with me wherever I went. I worked within healthcare in many different segments, outpatient, primary care, all these different ways.
Yeah.
And always boils down to like what I say in terms of like finding your back to the purpose. The purpose is around mental health, well-being, overall well-being of people, especially people who are Black. And my emphasis has really been on immigrants.
Right.
So being with UndocU Black Network, being a co-founder of that organization, was really on this idea of being like Black undocumented people in the United States, despite the fact that we exist, have received no kind of coverage, often are dismissed, often invisibilized as much as possible, and often told to that just keep your head down.
Yep.
Because if we win, you can win too. When the fact of the matter is, we are the marginalized group, and they're like should be elevated,
right,
for the most part.
Right.
So it was the idea of like, how do you, me, my role was bringing in the idea of like people's mental wellness and mm-hmm. how the importance of mental wellness and how you bring that. So as we started to organize and we started to strategize and we started to look at, you know, how do we engage in advocacy as an organization? That organization has, in the time that I was there, was 5.5 years. I left last September, two of which was me engaging as a co-executive director, was the idea of centering people's well-being as part of this, part of organizing.
Right.
Like, and so it was the idea of me bringing the things that I was already passionate with mm-hmm. into the space and people actually receiving it, understanding like, hey, you can't organize and focus on being either frontline or advocacy or any kind of thing. You can't engage in storytelling without considering people's well-being.
Right.
You can't think about what policies are going to be shifting and put into place without thinking about people's well-being.